A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today, we have the big honor of welcoming Dr. Jill Tarter. Jill, welcome to Coffee Break. How are you?
I'm doing well in this time of coronavirus. We're healthy and safe.
That's the most important thing. I hope all your family is okay, and I hope also that the confinement is bearable for you and your loved ones. You live in California, right?
I do. I live in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How are things over there?
Well, it's a beautiful day, and California, particularly the Bay Area region where I live, got ahead of the curve on locking down things, and so our rate of infection is lower than many other places.
Okay, I'm very happy to hear that. I've read some interviews. I'm a big fan of your work. You have described yourself as a tomboy when you were very young.
Yes.
That's a girl who would do things expected from a boy. Have the stereotypes changed? Do you think that it's easier now for a girl, for a girly girl to want to be a scientist?
Well, I think now that young girls have more models where they can see how they might participate in science and engineering in ways that I didn't have as a young person. So in that sense, it may be easier.
And that's thanks to people like you. And I know what I'm talking about. So who or what were your inspirations? What made you decide to be a scientist?
Well, I had this conversation with my father when I was about 8 years old. And this conversation was obviously motivated by my mother. And my father said to me, you know, you're getting older. You should spend more time with your mom doing girl things than you're spending with me doing your tomboy things. And I just was incensed. I was so angered by that suggestion. I didn't see why you had to choose to do one sort of thing and not another sort of thing. And so I just said, I'm going to be an engineer, because it was the most male occupation I could think of. And then sadly, my dad died a couple of years later, and I was left with that determination. I would like to make my dad proud of me, and I've said I'm going to do this, so damn it, I'm going to do it. And I got an engineering degree, and then sadly for the times, because it's not at all true today, but if you think back to the 60s, I don't know, are you old enough to think back to the 60s?
I'm not.
Yeah, well, you know, I said, after I got my engineering degree, I said, if engineers are as boring as my professors, I'm going to find something else that I want to do. And I realized that I had gotten a really good education in problem solving. I knew about solving problems, and I just needed to find something that where the problems were more interesting. And so I had the opportunity to take a bunch of graduate classes at Cornell, and there was this wonderful class in star formation taught by Ed Salpeter, just a fabulous professor. And I said, oh, wow, these are interesting problems. I want to do that. So it was, you know, it was not a direct path at all, but I ended up doing a PhD in astronomy and astrophysics.
Very, very nice. Can I ask you? I mean, your father, does the character in Contact reflect in any way your memories of him?
No, not at all. I mean, that character is someone. Remember, Contact was written before when SETI, or the high-resolution microwave survey, was a NASA project, and we were well-funded. And so Carl was unfortunately very accurate in his prediction that we would be unfunded as a government project and would have to raise money privately. And so Carl then, an amalgamation of a number of very well-to-do individuals, and thinking back to the previous century where there had been a lot of philanthropy financing astronomical projects like the Palomar telescope. So Carl predicted that, and it had nothing to do at all with my dad.
It's really amazing. I've also mentioned this to people when I talk about SETI, how it looks a little bit like Contact, where the public funding runs out and the protagonist has to try to seek funding from private investors. So let me ask you.
Well, actually, that's not when you get to the movie. That's not reasonable, because Carl Sagan actually served on our board of trustees at the SETI Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So he got the father dying young part correct, but the billionaire financier who eventually rescued the project, Paul Allen, once asked me if he thought that it was based on him.
Uh-huh. But yeah, I was referring to the fact that nowadays the big SETI projects like Breakthrough and other projects are funded by private philanthropy.
Right.
So what is, in your opinion, because SETI has had a history of ups and downs in terms of popularity and also support of funding agencies and academia in general. I mean, the perception of SETI in the academic community has changed over the years. How do you see the current climate for SETI right now in terms of the public, politicians, science, academic?
Over my career, there have been two enormous game changers. One is exoplanets, right? So when we started the NASA project, one of the things we started to do is hold workshops on how you might find planets elsewhere, because we didn't know about any. And that has paid off royally. I mean, it was Bill Borucki attended those workshops, and 25 years later, he was able to launch the Kepler spacecraft and provided a huge return in terms of planetary systems elsewhere. And the second game changer is extremophiles, right? When I was a student, I was told that life could exist only within a small range of parameters, right? Things that were comfortable for you and me. And now that's completely changed. We find that life is so adaptable that it exists in the most extreme conditions. Extreme for us, but not for the life. It's adapted to that. And so those two things, extremophiles and exoplanets, just make it absolutely obvious not only to ask whether exoplanets' inhabitable zones are inhabited, but are they inhabited by technological species? So it's much easier, less fringy today to begin to ask those questions that we started asking, 60 years ago. So in some sense, it's easier today, and we're not as often conflated with UFOs and other pseudoscience. It just seems natural to be asking this question.
Mm-hmm. And is that the reason why there is interest, apparently, of NASA to get back in this game nowadays? I don't know what's the current status of that. Are they starting to fund projects or thinking about it?
We're hopeful that they will be doing that, right? Mm-hmm. There have been some studies on technosignatures in preparation for the decadal review. Indeed, after 90, let me remember the date, 94, when Senator Bryan terminated the funding for NASA's SETI project, and he did so in a really appalling way. I mean, it made us the four-letter S word you couldn't say at headquarters forever, yeah. Right? So the extremophiles and exoplanets seems to have erased that and erased, hopefully, I mean, I think basically the background there was religious. I think there was some tension there. And today, as again, it just seems like it's much more mainstream, and it's a question we should be asking, and I hope that the federal government will get back into the funding of it.
Okay. Let me ask you, regarding this four-letter word, is that the reason or part of the reason behind the proposed change of nomenclature to search for technosignature? I know that you're not the only one who is... I myself also think it's a good idea that the technosignature makes more sense than intelligence in order to refer to the proxies that we can hope to look for. But maybe moving away from the word SETI, do you think that psychologically it will be beneficial in any way?
Well, I think so. And it's really, I started talking about technosignatures to emphasize within the astrobiology community the parallel with looking for biosignatures, right?
Yeah.
And also thinking ahead to these fantastic new telescopes that we're talking about building, right? On the ground and in space. Telescopes capable of imaging exoplanets, individual planets around other stars, and thinking about what those telescopes might see, as opposed to thinking only about looking for electromagnetic signals in the radio or the optical from technologies, and wondering what could we think about detecting with these large telescopes, and imagine that we got a telescope that was capable of actually directly imaging those seven Earth-like or Earth-sized planets around the TRAPPIST-1 star, right? They're all very close together, but they're all at slightly different distances from the star. Therefore, they should be at different temperatures. But what if we got a telescope that could actually look at them, see them, image them, and they all look the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that might imply some really large-scale astroengineering. And so it's another way of potentially detecting extraterrestrial technology. And so it seemed to me that it was just really reasonable to use a term, again, in parallel with biosignatures, but a term that got us away from thinking that the only way we could detect someone else's technology was finding a radio signal or an optical signal.
Hmm. Yeah, that was actually, it's interesting how that ties with the next question I wanted to ask you, because now we have, especially given all the progress that has been done in the science of exoplanet and these projects for these 30 and 40 meter class telescopes that you mentioned, hopefully the TMT will be built somewhere.
Maybe in your backyard.
Maybe around here, yes, but somewhere. And so we can now hope to look for mega engineering at a planetary scale, like you mentioned, and maybe in the future with better instrumentation, even smaller things. So there's all these array of technosignatures that we can think about. Then there's also the optical SETI, right? Search for laser beams. So it's like now the number of options is increasing, the number of things to look for. So is that a good or a bad thing? And how do you feel about these various technosignatures?
I'm really excited about it. So back in 1999, 2000, we held a series of workshops saying, what should we do in SETI for the next couple of decades? And one thing we said is we should build our own telescope so that we can be on the sky all the time. And we did that with the Allen Telescope Array. Second, we should push into the optical and the infrared because those technologies were just becoming available. But the third thing we said is we should figure out how to look at all the sky all the time so that we have some sensitivity to transient signals. So, at the SETI Institute, we've always focused on doing our signal detection in near real time. But even there, a signal had to be around for about half an hour before we could validate it. But if it just swept by our planet or was just beamed at us for a short period of time, we wouldn't have been able to say, yes, that's actually valid and real and we believe it. So what's exciting for me now is the fact that technologies have evolved to give us detectors that we think we can use in various ways to look at most of the sky or all of the sky all the time. So there's in Southern California at the University of San Diego, Shelley Wright is running a program called PanoSETI to build a couple of observatories that have hundreds of Fresnel lenses on the dome that focus large patches of the sky onto small detectors that can look for very fast optical pulses. And at the SETI Institute, we're not building observatories, we're building units based on very high grade astronomical cameras and gratings. And if we can build enough of these and put them at something like 16 or 20 sites around the globe, we will actually be able to look at all the sky all the time. And we're looking in the time domain, as is PanoSETI. We're looking for fast optical pulses that we haven't had any sensitivity to in the past. And so we might find the equivalent of Starshot laser array accelerating a sail that comes across our horizon quickly. Or we might find some deliberate pulses at this very short time scales, from nanoseconds to seconds. We also might find optical counterparts of other astrophysical phenomena that we didn't know about because we haven't been able to look. So I'm really excited about what technologies can allow us to do.
Because all of this technology would also be helpful to look for. I mean, it's often said, and I think it's true, that SETI is basically a science of searching for anomalies. And you can learn a lot about the universe by studying the most peculiar cases, right?
That's right. I mean, for radio astronomy, these fast radio bursts, of which maybe 10,000 are going off every day around the sky, and we've only found, well, now with Chime, hundreds, right? But we didn't know about them at all until 2007. So I don't think that we have finished with being entranced and surprised by the universe.
Given the time that it takes for signals to travel between stars, if we ever detect some signals from another civilization, artificial signals, do you think we could establish some form of a two-way dialogue, or would it be more like interstellar archaeology in terms of?
I think it would be more like the conversations that we have today with Shakespeare or the ancient Romans and the Greeks, right? Okay. I think it would be information transmitted in one direction. So you can learn a lot, even if you can't ask questions.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was referring to with the second option, because we are probably talking about hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years of lag. So maybe we pick up a signal and the people who send that signal are not even there anymore. Who knows?
I think the chances of that are small, right? Because most of the stars in our neighborhood of the galaxy are a billion years older than we are, right? Our sun is a relatively young star. And odds are, well, if technological civilizations are any younger than we are, they're not going to have any technology that we could detect. So the detectable civilizations are going to be older than us, statistically speaking, and therefore they've been around for a long time, and the probability that they would cease to exist in the time that it would take their message or their information to reach Earth, I think is small. I think they're old, they're and stable. And the really important thing is to figure out how we can get to be old and stable.
Oh, I agree. That's a really important question. But what worries me about this argument that you just brought up is that there's a really big separation of scales between these evolutionary scales of, at least on Earth, billions of years, and then the technological scales, which is basically hundreds of years.
I think that's actually one of the most important messages that SETI can perhaps succeed in providing to humanity, which is if we succeed in detecting something, it will only happen if civilizations, technological civilizations, on average, last for a long time, so that there is some reasonable chance that they will be cotemporal, that they will exist in that overlap in time through this 10 billion year history of our galaxy. And so, you know, even if we were just to get a cosmic dial tone, to me, that's extraordinarily hopeful in the sense that we know that it's possible to survive the technological adolescence that we exist in today. Somebody else made it through. Therefore, we can figure it out too. So it's this longevity, which is so important in the success of SETI. And you're quite right. If technological civilizations do not last for timescales that are long in terms of cosmic timescales, then we won't succeed. But if we do succeed, we know it's possible and we can do it too.
That's a really good point. Maybe it's a very important point to bring up in these times of global trouble.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay, and then related to that, do you have an opinion on this? There's this debate about red dwarfs, because these are these very old, extremely abundant stars, but at the same time, they're very violent, very active stars. And so on the one hand, it's where our observational bias makes it easier to observe, detect exoplanets, perhaps try to look for technosignatures. TESS is going to be observing lots of these red dwarfs, and doing light curve analysis. On the other hand, they might not be the most promising targets to look for life. So, I mean, I understand there is some debate going on about whether they are or not good candidates. Do you have any opinion on this debate?
Well, early on, we just threw them out, right? We said, no, it's not going to work. Among other things, if you're in the habitable zone of a red dwarf, your planet is probably tidally locked, which means one side faces the planet, faces the star continuously, like the moon and the Earth. But then we held some workshops in 2015 or so to look at this question in more detail, more than just the back of the envelope. And there were a lot of modeling and simulations that showed, well, you know, if there's enough wind, then you could transfer the heat from the substellar point around to the backside, and you might not freeze out your atmosphere. And there's been just a whole lot of scientific literature questioning, well, if the planet around a red dwarf developed an atmosphere, might it be spallated by the energetic outbursts of the red dwarf? And most red dwarfs seem to calm down after a billion years or so. So it's just an open scientific question. And because they're going to be the closest, some of the closest stars to us, I think we should look with every, you know, we should look for astronomical purposes to try and understand how the planet and the star are interacting. And we should look to see if we can find some evidence of technologies there. Hmm. Why not? Yeah. I at this point, maybe it's just my old age, but I'm more interested in being inclusive than excluding opportunities. Because I don't think our imagination is quite as good as we sometimes think it is.
Yeah, exactly. For example, we keep talking about planets all the time, and I keep having this idea that maybe we are being too restrictive by thinking only about planets, because I, you know, planets are dangerous places to live. On planets, you have meteorites falling, you have super volcanoes, you have a climate that is difficult to control. I would imagine that a technological civilization at some point, once you master space engineering and you master fusion, nuclear fusion energy, you would probably build space cities and go away from your planet and live safely in interplanetary or interstellar medium, just doing mining asteroids to get your materials. So perhaps civilizations are born on planets most of the time, but then they grow up and move away from home.
Right. Maybe. Another reason to talk about techno signatures, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
So, okay, let's say, how do you imagine, or I don't know if you've thought about this too much, but what do you think about post-contact? So let's suppose that at some point we get very, very lucky. We detect something. We can be very confident that it's an artificial signal, whether it's electromagnetic or some techno signature. There will be excitement all over the world. It will be crazy. How do you imagine that things will evolve after that? Because I would think that for a long time that will be all. There will not be much more that we can do about it.
Right. Well, I think first, once you've found another example of technological civilization beyond our own, you go looking for more, and you probably can get funding at that point to look for others, right? Because in physics, we count one to infinity, right? When you have a simple single example of a phenomena, it's possible that could be unique. But once you find a second, you know there are many. And so, we will go looking for others. But B, I worry that we'll get an unfortunate circumstance where there will be geographical isolation, in the sense that it could be what we find could be coming from so far to the north or so far to the south that certain countries will not have access to that part of the sky. And that would cause a tension, I would think. Or it might, in fact, consolidate a sense of global trust. We will either share information in a way that's transparent and everyone agrees that it's being shared with the countries that cannot gather it on their own, or it will enforce, oh my goodness, I don't know we're getting everything that we should. Maybe they're keeping something from us. You know, it's you know, we've held countless workshops on this question of the societal impact of the detection of extraterrestrial technologies. And in the end, all of these experts from all different realms of expertise, they end up saying, you know, it's going to depend on whatever circumstances are in play at the time, you know, whatever the planet is, whatever our political planet is like when this detection takes place is going to drive what the outcomes and the societal impacts are and how people behave. You know, it has always been the intent of the SETI researchers around the globe that I'm familiar with to share information. We even wrote a protocol back in the 80s, post-detection protocol, mainly to give some coverage for our Soviet colleagues who we were afraid might come under pressure to not reveal what they were finding. If there's a signal, if there's information, it's not coming to California or to Moscow. It's coming to the planet Earth, and the information is really belongs to all of humankind, and we intend to share it. But how the rest of the planet reacts might depend on whether they're sheltering from a decades-long pandemic and have developed these enormous silos to isolate themselves from others. Or, you know, we may have gotten our act together and worked globally to solve these challenges that don't respect national boundaries and therefore are really primed to have a global positive reaction to the announcement of someone else somewhere else.
I mean, what worries me, well, I've said this many times, but we are more and more a global society with global problems, and yet we are still organized in an, in my opinion, obsolete structure of nations, where the nations are the ultimate authority in any territory. But more and more, and pandemics are an example of that, our problems are global. We should have some global authority. What worries me about this scenario that you mentioned is that I just realized it's not only the problem of sharing the information, it's also the problem of what to do next. Let's say somebody decides that it would be a good idea to respond to that message, signal, whatever, whereas some other people might consider it a bad idea to respond to that message. How do we deal with that? Let's say that America wants to send a response message, and China or Russia or Europe decides, no, that's not a good idea. What do we do then? I mean, it will be a very difficult situation.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the 80s we wrote this protocol, this post-detection protocol. And one of the articles in there said that the folks that signed up to this protocol agreed not to transmit a response until there was a global consensus on who should speak for Earth and what should they say. Well, that's nice words, but there's absolutely no way to enforce that. And I think in reality, any entity that had a transmitter would probably decide that they were going to send whatever they wanted to send. And there's no way, there's no enforcement possible there. And then...
Well, individual nations could enforce something.
But... think about the FCC and the International Telecommunications Union for broadcast frequency allocation and theoretically arranging all of this, right? So that people have access to different parts of the spectrum. I mean, the spectrum, when it goes on auction, sells for, in the radio, $1 billion a megahertz, right? It's, and there's no enforcement. Out of band transmissions are unenforceable. You can't get somebody to stay in their allocation. We don't practice spectral hygiene because there's really no enforcer. So, you know, thinking about this, I always chuckle because Freeman Dyson, who we just lost, used to say to me, look, this cacophony of different transmitters, different messages, no coordination is actually probably the best characterization of the planet today. Right? It tells a lot about how we are not a homogeneous global entity. So, yeah. Don't know. I mean, I think it's, we don't currently live in a society, in a global society that's structured in a way that could implement some kind of protocol and restriction on this. Okay. But, you know, that's actually, that's one of the reasons that I so enjoy talking to public audiences. Because if they, you know, are kind enough to spend some time listening to what I have to say, it has to, at some level, change their perspective to make them think about themselves in a larger context. It's I'm hoping that it's trying to move them into a more cosmic perspective, one that then sets them up to be willing to take on all the challenges that you just mentioned, that don't respect national boundaries and work together to solve them globally. So I usually try and give audiences a homework assignment, which is, you know, when they leave wherever they are, go pick up all these wonderful devices that we have and go look at their profiles and change in their profiles the first thing they say about themselves and say that I'm an earthling, right? And then try and act like it.
I'm going to do that. Just right.
Good.
When we finish this conversation, I will do that. Okay, just to finish, I think my last question, it's not about searching for intelligence, it's about searching for life in general, which we discussed at the beginning. I think we are living a very, very fascinating time in history because for the first time, thanks to these 30 and 40 meter class telescopes, we are in a position where apparently, and I think most experts agree on this, or at least many experts agree on this, that finding life elsewhere through biomarkers in exoplanets is probably something that is going to happen very soon during our lifetime, probably.
Well, I'm a bit older. That really makes me, the only thing that I don't like about being old is that I may not get the answer to that question.
Well, let's hope let's hope that you still have many more years. Who knows? I mean, maybe I have less than you do. You never know. But you know, nowadays I think humans and in your case, women can have a life expectancy on average that is certainly above 85. I think is the average in
Spain.
Yeah,
you know, in the U.S., it's going down for the past few years. After all of these decades of life expectancy increasing, it's actually going down, and that's because of the economic disparity that we have in our country, the haves and the have-nots. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt because you were going somewhere else.
I was going, yeah, but this is very interesting. Sometimes we think about the universe and we forget about the problems that we have here at home, right? And it's also important to think about that. And I think the two things are connected because when you can think about big problems, you can put them into perspective and you're in a better position to think about solutions to the problems that we have at home.
Caleb Scharf, who's the chairman of the astrobiology department at Columbia University, has a lovely way of saying that. He says, on a finite world, a cosmic perspective is a necessity, not a luxury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fully agree. So from that perspective and thinking that we might witness that moment, the moment where we can finally point at some location on the sky and say there's life there. What do you think would happen then? I mean, do you think that this would, you mentioned religion at the beginning of this conversation. Do you think it will create tensions with people with a certain religious belief? Do you think it will change the way we look at things a little bit?
Well, I hope it would change the way we see ourselves and make us appreciate ourselves in a much bigger context, right? In terms of organized religion, that's been around for thousands of years. And what we know about the universe has certainly changed over those many millennia. And yet organized religion has managed to readjust to fit in to our new knowledge base, and it's still here. So I'm not sure that the religious tensions would be the most dire. I think that, it's hard to know because there are surveys in our country, in the United States, that say that half of the people in this country believe that we've already been visited by extraterrestrial beings. And if that's the case, if half are already there, it's not going to be a huge shift to get the other half to encompass the fact that we are not alone in the universe. So I don't know. Again, I go back to these many conferences and workshops we've held to try and understand how humanity, or at least the United States version of it, would react to this information. And, you know, basically, at the end of the day, you come up saying, you know, we paid your airfare for this kind of advice that the world will respond in terms of whatever belief systems are in play at the time. You know, I think we're not really good at predicting that. Again, we haven't faced many globally altering circumstances, at least in my lifetime. We had some world wars, and that was pretty awful. But now, this pandemic is really shattering. It's altering the way we exist. And I don't necessarily see any bad actors in the global response. So we see nation states that are able to enforce isolation in a way that others are unwilling to, But no one has said that that's the wrong thing to do. We are, in fact, looking at the science and hopefully acting globally in accordance with the science. And I think that's the best thing we can do. And if we all do it, we will get through this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that might be the best lesson. Listen to the science to try to overcome our difficulties. Okay, Jill, thank you for your time. I have many more questions I'd like to ask, but I think I've already taken enough of your time. Maybe some other day we can continue this conversation. But it's been a real pleasure, and I hope the overall situation in California and everywhere else in the world will get better soon. Thank you, and stay safe.
You too.